Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by the one and only Jeff Goodman of Stadium Sports. Jeff is the leading sports writer for basketball and really needs no introduction, so we'll jump right into it. We hope you enjoy, and if you are enjoying what we're doing here at the Rising Coaches podcast, please write us a review, give us a little feedback. We'd appreciate it. We hope you enjoy. Jeff, how are you? I appreciate you being on the podcast today.
No, it's great to be on. I'm glad you're doing well and glad to be on.
Yeah. Can you believe, Jeff, it was 10 years ago in 2010 that you came and spoke at our first Rising Coaches Conference at the New York Hotel in some back meeting room with maybe 32 guys in there?
I remember it well. Trust me, I remember it well. I think my biggest thing for that was to make sure I didn't show up hungover at all.
I'm not sure you were successful with that.
I think I was all right. I think I probably left some money at the blackjack table the night before, but I think I was okay. And as I've gotten older, 10 years ago, I could go a lot harder than I go now in Vegas. So I'm very disappointed that Vegas has been taken off the AAU slate this year. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm booking a trip to Colorado Springs instead of Vegas. It's very disappointing.
Yeah, there's a big difference between Vegas and Colorado Springs.
I've never been. I've never been to Colorado Springs. I've heard just okay things about it, so I'm not thrilled to be going to Colorado Springs, but it is what it is. We'll see good players.
Yeah, no question. Jeff, I wanted to first let me say this. You're, and I know you won't ever say this, but I'll say it. You're the leading journalist, and it used to just be college basketball. Now probably in basketball in general. And I really think, I've known you about 10 years or so, and your approach, your humbleness, you never big time anybody, you're down to earth, and just an all-around good dude. And I would guess that has a lot to do with you achieving the status you have in your career. So I just want to say that and how much I appreciate
Thanks,
you.
Man. I appreciate it. And that probably only cost me $100 to get you to say those words. But I do appreciate it. I think there's a lot of people that would agree with you, and then there's a lot of people that hate my guts. And I get it. Like, that's – I'm okay with that now. I don't know if I was 10, 15 years ago, but like my biggest thing, and I guess I've always been like this to some degree, of I'm going to try to be honest and truthful with the information that I have and give my opinion. And a lot of them are going to be wrong, and I'm hoping way more are going to be right, but I'm going to give my opinion, and my opinion is going to come from work and information that I've either gathered or seen or whatever, or just, from being out. And I've always felt like, listen, the one thing, like, nobody's ever going to fire me or get rid of me for not working hard enough. And I love what I do. That's the best part of what we do. Right. I mean, and I never thought I'd get to the point where I've gotten to in my job, like money-wise too. Like, when I got into this job, kind of like you, I mean, I remember the first thing when I got out of school, my first job was freelancer for the Worcester Telegram and Gazette here in Massachusetts. And I would cover like Little League, making like $25 a story, $25 a story. And if I went outside of the area, if I had to drive like a half an hour, I'd make 35. And it was like the biggest thing ever, because, you just another $10 for driving, another 15 minutes, I'm making out here. That's kind of the cool part of it for me, is being able to support my family in a pretty good way, doing something that I love, where I thought I'd be making nothing.
That's what it's all about. At what point did you know you wanted to be in sports journalism, and was it always basketball for you?
I interviewed James Worthy, was the first person I ever interviewed, and I did it when I was, I believe, 14 years old. I still have the tape. I went down to the hotel in Boston when the Lakers came in and played the Celtics, and it must have been the day before the game. Probably just got back maybe to the hotel or going to shoot around, if I had to guess. And I'm like 14, me and my buddy. And I went up to him and asked him if we could interview him, he and Michael Cooper separately. And they both say, yeah, call me later, call us later at the hotel. So we get back home and I'm like, oh shit. Like, what questions am I going to ask? Number one, we didn't have any questions written up. So we write down a bunch of dumb questions, you know, who was your idol when you were younger? I don't know. Yeah. A bunch of questions like that, that just weren't very good. And then I'm like, all right, how do I record this thing? Like, I don't know how to record it. Well, back then my dad and everybody, like, you have these answer machines and these little micro cassettes within the answer machine. So I hit the button, the record button. The problem was James Worthy could hear it on the other end, that it was beeping every 2 or 3 seconds. We beep, beep. And like, this dude did, he and Michael Cooper did the whole interviews. And my voice hadn't even changed yet. I think I was 14. My voice hadn't changed. So like, he's doing this interview with somebody who sounds like they're like 9, and it's going beep, beep, beep throughout the entire interview. And neither one of them wavered at all. They were awesome. So I knew I wanted to do this. I knew I wasn't going to be a good enough ball player to play at a high, high level. You know, I'm limited athletically. So I always knew I wanted to do it. And kind of got really lucky.
Was basketball always your passion? You just being in Boston, you grew up a Celtics fan, and that was it for you?
No, I covered everything. So when I got out of college, I freelanced for the Associated Press, and I would cover Red Sox. I would cover Bruins. Bruins I haven't been to in years. But even before I got into college hoops, I was doing – leading right up to it, like 2000 – maybe early 2000s, I was covering Patriots. Even when I worked at Fox, I was jumping in and covering Patriots playoff games a lot. But basketball was certainly, I was more passionate about it. And I think it started here in Boston, believe it or not, with Celtics and even Boston College in the Big East. And then when I went to school at Arizona, that's when it obviously went to a different level.
And how did you... maybe it wasn't a decision, maybe this decision was made for you, but how did you find your niche in college basketball and really corner that market?
Kind of by accident. You know, like I said, I mean, I'm looking on my wall right now, and I did a lot of freelance. I have a story here on Tom Brady. What was this? This was like after his rookie year in the Washington Post. I wrote a bunch of stories for USA Today on everything. I remember they sent me to Pittsburgh to do a story. The Houston Astros had come in and were playing Pittsburgh and had been on a crazy roll. So I did a story in the Astros spent 3 days in Pittsburgh and wrote something for USA Today. But it was kind of when I left, I worked for the Associated Press in New York, Buffalo, and then New York. And then I took a job with a company called School Sports, a startup. They paid a ton of money when the startups kind of were booming. And I just kind of fell into basketball recruiting. There wasn't a whole lot of, it was like kind of do what you want to degree, but they were covering high school stuff and they weren't covering like the best high school players. And I decided I'm going to try to do stories on the elite players. And I remember one of the things that happened that kind of jump-started it was I was doing stories on like the top basketball players, like Rashard McCants. And I asked him, hey, what's the latest with your recruitment? And he said, I just got off the phone and I committed to North Carolina. So I wrote it up and it was the first story I ever broke. And I didn't even know I broke it. Like, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll write it up. And Carolina fans, I didn't realize how insane they are. I broke it. And it was like this rush of like breaking a story and what it meant. And again, I had no idea at the time what it meant. And then it was like a drug in a sense of like, oh, this is great. I'm going to keep trying to break stories. So I did that at School Sports, covered mostly a lot of basketball, and then went to Scout and worked with Dave Tellett for a little while, did that. And then Fox bought Scout. So I went from being full-time just recruiting guy for years to then begging them to let me write a college basketball column in 2006 for $50 a column. And then for the next, I think it was 2 or 3 years. I think I did both for 2 years. I think 2006 and seven, I think I covered, or seven and eight, maybe I covered recruiting full time and covered college hoops full time. And I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I, I don't know how my wife stayed with me.
So you broke. That's crazy. I didn't know that story. And now, like, yeah. People are always trying to break news, especially with social media. Was that a big thing at that time? You know, being the first to break a story, or was that kind of the beginning of that movement where it's so important to be the one to break it?
Yeah, it really wasn't for me. And then you learn, like, okay, you start following a little bit more as you get into college basketball, and you learn, like, I don't remember what years, but like Andy Katz had kind of a stranglehold on breaking news with college basketball. I remember, like, Greg Doyle is a guy I really liked. He was at CBS, and at that time I was a recruiting guy, but I remember Greg because he went to ABCD camp every year and just met him and really liked him. Just, I'm a huge fan of Greg Doyle. He always treated me really well when I was some recruiting guy that nobody knew who the hell I was or, you know, whatnot. So I would try to give him some scoops of coaching stuff because I had nowhere to break it at that point. And then I went to Fox and kind of had free reign to do what I wanted because Fox really didn't care about college hoops. So they let me do whatever the hell I wanted. I remember going to a tournament. Where was it? It must have been like Puerto Rico. I would bounce around a lot. And I went to Puerto Rico and called in from that Puerto Rico tournament, the tip-off or whatever the hell it was in the preseason, and called in. I'm like, hey, yeah, I'm going to send this story. And, like, nobody knew I was even in Puerto Rico. Like, Fox was that way. Like, they didn't care about college hoops, which was great in a sense for me because I could do whatever I wanted. But, again, there was no infrastructure to really support it that much. So when I had a chance to go from Fox to CBS, it was a no-brainer for me because CBS, obviously, they had Gary Parrish. My guys Norlander and Borzello had just gone to CBS. So those 2 years were awesome. They were fun. Those 2 years were great because CBS just kind of let us do what we did. And we had great college football guys then too. And then it kind of fell apart fairly quick there from a college's perspective.
Was there a leadership change that led to that or what happened?
Yeah, ESPN just came plucking. They got McMurphy. I think who else did we have that left? Bruce Feldman maybe from college football. And then they went after me. And it was a brutal – I mean, honestly, it was a really, really hard decision for me because I love CBS. I love the management, which has since changed. I love the people. I love working with Parrish, Norlander, and Borzello. But it was one of those things where, like, when ESPN comes calling, I'm like, how do I say no? Like, how do I say no? It's significantly more money, and it's an opportunity to work at ESPN and maybe be on TV. Like, I didn't even know when I went to ESPN, like, how much I'd be on TV, if I'd ever, you know, be on TV. And I remember one talent person in ESPN, it was Seth Greenberg. Yeah, Greenberg basically said when I came out, he's like, you know, you're probably never going to really be on TV.
All right.
Not much. And I'm like, all right, whatever. Like, I'm a writer. I'm not a TV guy. So, and the first time I ever went on TV for SportsCenter was I'm there a week and Brad Stevens gets the Celtics job. And it's like the perfect storm for me, right? I'm in Boston. Obviously, I know the Celtics guys well. I know Brad better than any media person, I think, at that point, anyone. So I'm on the 9 a.m. SportsCenter with Janine Edwards hosting. And I'm like shaking. Like visibly, like shaking. I'm so nervous. And she was awesome with me, though. She was so cool and just made it as easy and painless as she could make it for somebody that absolutely sucked on TV. And I think I sucked for the first few years. I really do. I think I was terrible on TV because I overthought it. And I would get upset. Like, you know, you'd stumble on one word and it would eat me up after the segment. But, you know, it depends who you're with, too. Like, if I was with, like, Scott Van Pelt or Kevin Negande on SportsCenter, it was easy. But, you know, if you were in a spot, like, sideline is hard. Sideline's the hardest thing, and I learned this, just because you've only got, like, 20 seconds to jump in. And as reporters, we've got all this deep, the depth of information that we have that we want to share. But you got 20, 25 seconds in there, yeah, in your ear saying rap, rap, rap.
Right.
So you can't get any of the good shit out there.
What went into, so is it kind of fair to say, or at least from my perspective, you kind of made your reputation and really rose to the top of the sp- basketball journalism world by being a trusted, reliable source to break news. So what was the secret for being able to get that scoop and break news as often as you did?
It's easy. I mean, it's easy. I lucked out. I lucked out in a sense that I covered recruiting. And you're seeing other people do it now and try to break news college-wise. When I covered recruiting, like, I owned it. I would call 5-6 kids every night. I knew every kid so well, and I broke so many stories. Now it's like an embarrassment. Like, nobody breaks a story anymore. It's all broken by the kid on Twitter.
Right.
Like, I used to break most of the stories when kids would commit, I would end up breaking. And that's kind of the way it was. And, you know, part of it is journalism has changed. But, I think the biggest thing for me was I already had the relationships in place with all the college coaches who would call me because they knew I had information about all these kids. So then when I went and I started covering college too, when I reverse field and called the college coaches, they were more apt to trust me. They were more apt to give information to me because I had been giving information to them for years. So I already knew every college coach. Now, I'm not as good now as I used to be because I don't go out. I don't recruit. I don't know the top kids anymore. I would love to be able to do that. But I've kind of gone I probably spread myself a little too thin and tried to do some NBA stuff, which is taken away. And I have a family now. So it's hard. I got a 15-year-old daughter. So it's harder to be on the road all the time when you're my age now than I was when I was in my early 30s, when I'm like, screw it, I'm just going to go out and, you know, work all hours of every day. Now you find that balance a little bit more. You have to.
And you were working at, like, you were an assistant coach. You were on the phones every single night with kids trying to develop relationships and yeah. get them to trust you. Did it ever get to the point where they were asking you for advice?
Service. Yeah. Oh yeah. All the time. I mean, I remember the kid, Emmanuel Negative, who went to Tennessee, played at Brewster. And I remember him asking me, you know, like a bunch of kids would ask me, what situation's good? And I remember him asking me the question, like, do you think, will Lute Olson still be, he was considering Arizona. Will Lute Olson still be at Arizona? Because he was going through some health issues and everything like that. I went to school at Arizona. And I answered him truthfully. I was like, no, I don't. I don't. Often, I would stay away from most giving opinions of like where a kid should go. But if they had like, if they had questions about like who's coming in, what's he like, those types of things that are more factual based questions, I would answer them. And I feel bad. There's a lot of times when I didn't, when I should have. Like, there's a lot of kids now and I've run into over the last five, you know, years or whatever. I see them, they're in their, you know, late 20s or 30s now, and they went to the wrong spot, and I knew it, and I couldn't, you can't say anything. What are you going to do? You're going to tell the kid not to go? Couldn't. That's not my job.
Right. Jeff, I feel like there's a fine line between using, for a coach, between using the media wisely and using it poorly. And I'm not talking so much about head coaches. I'm talking about more assistant coaches. Who are some of the assistant coaches over the years that were really, really savvy at using that as a resource? Well, let's start there before we get to the negative.
I'm trying to think of, like, good coaches that have – I mean, listen, it's all about relationships, right? Like to me – I'm never going to put my name on something. Like, I'm not going to be a mouthpiece for coaches. I'll put out information if it's factual information. But, like, I had one coach call me last year, and he was like, we're going to be terrible. We're going to stink. Can you put it out there that we're going to be the worst team in the league? And I'm like, no, I'm not going to put it out there. Like, hell no. Like, that's not what I do. Like, if I believe it, I'll tweet it. I don't think you're going to be the worst team in the league, so I'm not going to put it out there.
Right.
Well, 5 minutes later, another so-called national reporter puts the same thing out there. Literally, the coach called after he got off with me. He called another national reporter And that national reporter, you could probably figure out who it was. I mean, it's a joke. Like that. That's my problem these days with some so-called journalists. They're journalists and they're mouthpieces. And like, to me, again, I understand journalism's changed. Doesn't mean I got to be happy with it. Like, I hate the fact that people just sit there and will wear people out with texts these days. It kind of happened back in the day with the fan sites for a while. There would be a ton of fan sites for like Carolina popping up, and they'd all hit the same kid, and they just wear these kids out. I'll text somebody once, maybe twice, and then I'm done. If you don't get back to me after once or twice, you don't want to get back to me. Right. I'm not going to wear you down. I'm not going to text you every day, good luck, coach, on every game day. Like, come on, man. Like just objective. Try to be objective. Like try to be objective. Try to, when I wake up every day, like, I feel good about the fact that I'm not going to be a mouthpiece for anybody. That's just not me. I'm going to sell it. I'm going to say it straight. Again, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I just feel like there's some people in the journalism world now that are claiming to be journalists that just aren't, period.
Yeah, no question. I feel like there's a way to use a relationship with somebody in the media to your advantage and be resourceful. And I'll give you an example. When I got to Clemson as the GA, I had come from Division II in junior college. And at those levels, like, people really don't know who you're recruiting. And so it was a big deal to keep that a secret so people wouldn't find out. And I remember getting to Clemson and sitting with Josh Pastorino, who was on the staff at that time. And, you know, he would get excited about a kid that he was recruiting. And the first thing he'd do is call, who was it at the time? Oh, whoever our scout guy was for the Clemson Tigers.
The Clemson scout guy.
Yeah. Or maybe it was Dave Tellup or Evan Daniels or whoever. Yep. But he'd like, hey, we're recruiting this kid. I like him. Can you do a little write-up on him? And that was just, you know, mind-blowing to me because I had been raised in don't tell anybody, keep it a secret. Kind of, I guess maybe it's a high major level thing where, you know, you want that excitement and exposure to kind of generate some excitement.
And then I think it's one of those things where it was the thing to do at that point too, right? You wanted to be able to tell a kid that, hey, I'll get you some publicity. You know, if you could sell that, it's the same thing now. Like, people are saying, like, you know, if you can get them and their decision on ESPN, which they don't really do any anymore, but if you can get a kid's commitment on ESPN and you can sell that, hey, I got the relationship, I can get that done and get it on a show or something like that. I mean, it's just something you can sell.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, Jeff, let's shift gears, man. What is wrong with college basketball today? There's so much out there, and it's such kind of a dark time for it with the FBI case. And what is the problem, and what's the solution? Tell me. Talk to me.
Oh, boy. I mean, I think the problem now is, again, you're having a lot of coaches at this point. I think the biggest problem right now is you've got a lot of assistant coaches and in actuality, a lot of black assistant coaches that are getting fired, that were the ones that were on the firing line in this FBI deal, when a lot of the head coaches know exactly what their assistants are doing, but they look the other way. Their hands are clean of it. Yeah, they'll get hit with coaches control or whatever you want to call it, you know, not monitoring their program well enough, and they'll get hit with suspensions. But Book Richardson's never getting another job in college basketball, and neither is Tony Bland or Lamont Evans or Steve Smith at Clemson, who says something about the Clemson football program, and he's gone. So I just, you know, I don't know if you can clean it up completely, because I just think there is too much money in it. And I think paying players, I get it. I understand it all. I think the best way to do it would be giving players the opportunity to make some money based on kind of the money they bring in, right? Give them a piece of the jersey sales. Give them the opportunity to do autograph sessions if they want to do it or something else. And then that money goes into a fund and they get it when they leave school or they get it when they graduate, however you want to do it. I don't know, but give them some incentive where they do get, they get something. But I do think there's value, and people lose track of the fact there's value in an athletic scholarship. I mean, that's a lot of money. I'm going to end up paying, my daughter's 15. She's going to college in 3 years. My guess is I'm going to end up paying $250,000 plus in those 4 years. So that's a lot of damn money that I get. These players, some of Zion Williamson's making a lot more for Duke than $250,000. But is Marquise Bolden? I mean, what the hell has Marquise Bolden brought in for Duke in actuality? Nobody's buying his jersey. Whether it's Marquise Bolden is benefiting from Duke more than Duke is benefiting from Marquise Bolden or the 9th, 10th, or Javon Delorier or those guys. There's only a few guys that are making huge money for their programs. Let's face it. How many guys are Clemson where you are, like, how many guys are making big money for basketball? I'm talking football, obviously it's a different story, but like Marquise Reed isn't making huge money for Clemson basketball.
Right. No, I think I agree with you, and I know it's a controversial topic, but let them sell their likeness. And if they are, you know, a stud on their team, then they'll get more endorsement deals or with a local,
yep,
whatever, car dealership, right, or anything. And if you're the 10th guy, you're probably not going to have many people beating down your door. But I know that opens a whole nother, you know, bag of problems, but I agree with you on that. What do you think the NCAA is going to do?
I don't know how we clean it up. Adam, I don't know how we clean it up. That's right. The problem. I don't know how you're going to – yeah.
Do you think they'll do anything once FBI cases are over with? Yeah. Will the NCAA drop the hammer? Are they going to do anything? I mean, what's the Tarkanian quote that the NCAA is so mad at, what, Kentucky, that they put Cleveland State on probation for another 2 years? Like,
exactly.
Is that exactly what we're going to see, or what do you think?
No, I think they'll hit these programs, but I think they'll hit them in a year or 2 years, and I think all these head coaches are going to get hit with, you know, lengthy suspensions. I don't know if it's going to be 10 games. I don't know if it's going to be a year. I'm not really sure at this point. And the hard part for me, and I've said this before, is like with a guy like Sean Miller. All right, like stuff happened within the program. Do I think he knew? As I told you, yes, I think he knew what was going on. I don't know if he knew all the specifics, but I think he knew what was going on. Okay. But I also think you need to prove it. Like these allegations that are out there that Brooke Richardson's talking about, that Sean Miller was directly involved in the paying of DeAndre Ayton or players or whatnot. I still feel like, isn't that our the core of what we're about as a society, as an American society, and our legal system is like innocent until proven guilty. And again, I'm not saying Sean Miller's innocent completely. I think from an NCAA perspective, he should be suspended based on the NCAA's current setup. But nobody, it wasn't like he was on trial. If he did pay somebody, let's face it, if he paid somebody, he would have been in that courtroom this past week. If they had anything, he would have been in the courtroom on trial. So he didn't. And my biggest thing always is like, and you tell me, because you've been around this more than I have. All right, so if I'm a coach and I'm dealing with Christian Dawkins, and Christian Dawkins tells me, hey, I need 20 grand from you for this player. Let's say he's got Brian Bowen. I need, you know, 5 installments of 20 grand. But I want to get that kid. I'm going to be like, hey, yeah, I got you, man. Don't worry, I got you. We'll take care of you. We'll talk about it later. And I got you covered. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to say flat out no right away because I want to get that kid. And I don't know how much juice Christian Dawkins has with that kid, but I'm going to play the game up until the 11th hour. And then I got a decision to make. Am I going to pay him or not?
Right. Right. Yeah, you're right. A lot of, that's probably the norm. That's probably what most people do. And probably what you have to do a little bit is play that game. And, you know, because you don't know who has influence. And this guy may be asking for all this stuff. And maybe he has none, so you really don't need to tell him no. Maybe the kid will shut him out eventually.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's a hard one. And I feel like that was the way that honestly, that a guy like Sean Miller or Will Wade or whoever would get fired was if something comes out, a conversation, I mean, there was one with Will Wade, but if there's something that comes out that these presidents, school presidents hear the conversation between their head coach and a Christian Dawkins, and even if the money never changed hands, just the fact that it was out there and they heard it, I think the coach would be fired the next day. But that stuff never came out in this trial, which was surprising to me because, well, maybe not. I mean, I think, you know, Steve Haney, Christian Dawkins' lawyer, tried to get some of those conversations as evidence, and he wasn't able to.
And now, and Will Wade is a hero, and Bruce Pearl's a hero, and those guys are the wealthiest people on their campuses. It's crazy. It's a crazy deal.
I feel like maybe there's something that should be implemented where if you're a head coach and you get hit with some sort of, you know, some level of violation, you're done. You're done forever. If you're a head coach, assistant coach, whatever. Like, I know it sucks because we're all about second chances as a society, and I've screwed up plenty, you know, when I was a kid, whatever, and probably screwed up this week. But I do feel like at some point, should we take a stand here? And I think ADs don't give a shit. They just want to win. They're just going to sell out and hire guys no matter what, instead of, you know, only hiring a guy that I feel like, you know, it represents the right things about coaching and teaching and dealing with these kids.
Yeah, they want to make money. And guys who have the best players usually are the guys that are winning. And those deep NCAA tournaments bring in a lot of money. Well, so you mentioned ADs, and you talk about search firms quite a bit. Tell us about, like, the cycle that search firms and the role they play, and nothing against them, more power to them for figuring out the system. But, like, are search firms hiring school presidents, and then school presidents turn around and hiring search firms that are now hiring the ADs, and then they hire a search firm again to hire the coach? Like, where does this end? Is this a problem? Is there some conflict of interest here? Talk to me a little bit about that.
It's a joke. Yeah, a lot of it's a joke because, again, I feel like, all right, if you had search firms that had intimate knowledge of what's going on within the industry, and if I saw those search firms out at all these AAU tournaments and they were actually watching coaches, they were talking to coaches, it's one thing. All right, so that's my first problem with them. Is I think you've got people running these search firms that have no idea what they're doing. Some of them. Now, some of them are good or better than others. And then you've got what you're talking about, which is it's kind of a whole scam in a sense of like, all right, you know, search firm, you're going to place this guy as the athletic director at a mid-major program. Well, he wants to move up to a high-major program. So every job that opens, volleyball coach, croquet coach, whoever the hell it is, he's going to hire that search firm again or another one, whatever, just to give him the opportunity. He's just throwing money, even if he doesn't need to. Like, to me, if you're a good AD, and I know, listen, I get at times at the highest level that you need coverage, right? You need coverage because you don't want to reach out to that guy. But, like, let's look at, like, Greg Byrne, a good example. Greg Byrne at Alabama. Hired Nate Oates at Buffalo without a search firm. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. If you're good at your job and you've got a good network, you're going to be able to figure it out. Like, Greg Byrne called me multiple times this year, during the year, not to run names past me, but now looking back on it, within the conversation, I know he was listening to what I was saying. I know he was kind of poking around and just preparing. And that's all you got to do. If you're a good AD, if I get a job as an AD, like, wherever I am, mid-major school, I'm going to be talking to as many people as I can. And when my job opens up, I'm not going to need a search firm. I'm not. I'm not pissing away 75 grand, 50 grand, whatever it's going to be, to a search firm. My job, especially with the revenue sports like football and basketball, my job is to do that on my own. And whether I got to call some other people within the business that can then reach out. Like, Dan Guerrero screwed it up at UCLA. But he screwed it up because he was just bad business. like not to know Jamie Dixon's buyout. Like UCLA did what they had to do early. They couldn't get a big boy. They couldn't get Calipari. They couldn't get Tony Bennett, all those guys, Jay Wright, whoever. Now, they needed to move quicker on that. And I think that, again, is on Dan Guerrero and his administration, because they needed to move quicker so that when the season ended, they knew who they had immediately. They knew it was going to be Mick Cronin at that point. They were going to hire him right away. Or they knew the deal with Jamie Dixon, and at that point, you couldn't navigate his buyout because it was too much money. And yeah, I still think it's comical that Jamie Dixon for a moment thought TCU was going to pay a dollar of his buyout. I mean, like, why? Why the hell would TCU pay a dollar of his buyout? They wouldn't. Somebody had to pay it. So UCLA should have known that ahead of time, so they weren't going to screw around with Jamie Dixon. So they could have just, season over, we're hiring Mick Cronin, we're done with it. Hammer us all you want, but it's not a shit show.
Right, right. So it's not so much the decision that they made, but the way they went about doing it and the time they wasted right along the process. All right, what about you? Yeah. You've been real outspoken about the Mike Anderson hire to St. John's, and I just want to hear a little bit, like, yeah, why. Because I think I have a different take on it.
I mean, it's easy for me. The guy's been in Alabama, Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma for 37 years. New York's a different animal, man. Like, it's a different animal. And when you come to New York and you got no ties to New York, it's going to take a while to get up to speed. That's number one. Number two, what job was perfect for Mike Anderson? What was his perfect job? Like, if he could have had any job 8 years ago, what would it have been? Arkansas, right?
That was his dream job, yeah.
Dream job, fit him perfectly. He knew the landscape. Everybody loved him there. I believe he went to two NCAA tournaments, maybe three. What did he go, two or three? But he didn't get past the first. He won two NCAA tournament games. I think he went three in 8 years. And he won two games against Wofford and Seton Hall while he was there. He did not do a great job at Arkansas. He was fired. Obviously, he didn't do a great job. If he did a great job, he'd still be there. He did not do a great job at the job that was ideal for him. And now you're going to say, we're going to hire him at a job that is completely outside of his comfort zone, at a job that's difficult in the Big East. It's a mid-tier job in the Big East, where Arkansas, you could make a case, is it's a top four job in the SEC, I think. I think it's a top third job in the SEC. And you're going to put him in New York City right now. And I'm not even going to go with the age factor, because my wife told me I shouldn't.
Like, it's below the belt.
Not right to do. But I'm getting older, too.
Right.
You can hammer me for my age anytime you want. I don't care. But, like, he's almost 60 years old. And I know at 47, I don't have the same type of energy I had at 37. Maybe Mike Anderson's an animal, and, like, he 59, he's going to outwork everybody. But yeah, to me, again, I think it was a bad hire, period. A bad hire.
Well, and I'm not here to convince you, but for my, and I don't know Mike Anderson.
Here.
Yeah. I don't know Mike Anderson at all. I've shook his hand before and after games over the years, and that's about it. And I really don't know anyone who's been on his staff, but my perception, and again, I could be completely off base on this, is that he does it the right way and doesn't cheat in recruiting. And you know,
I agree with that.
Yep. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that's my perception. And I think even though Arkansas is where he had ties to and might have been his dream job, I don't think the SEC is the place to be if you're not going to be paying kids. Or maybe that's too extreme a statement, but that's
good call.
That's not a good fit if you're in a league full of, you know, schools that are notorious for that over the years. And so I think he was really successful at UAB. I think he was really successful at Missouri. And he wasn't like, you know, Arkansas, he wasn't successful enough, I guess, obviously. But it wasn't like they were an embarrassment. I mean, they were winning 20 games a year on average. So, like, I think he did a decent job, but I think it's really hard. And in terms of the New York City thing, like, I think they tried that. And I personally think that's overrated. You know, they went with Chris Mullin, and which they made the tournament, and I don't think he did as terrible a job as people think. And they got, you know, Steve Lavin, and I think he did a decent job. But I think the thing that, when you're at a hard job, I think the thing that you have to have is some sort of unique identity. You got to go outside the box. So, like, at Clemson, when I was there 10 years ago with Oliver Purnell, Clemson's a hard job. This is before football had it rolling like they do now. And so you got to do something different. And for Oliver Purnell, it was the press. And so we didn't need five-star guys. We needed the best athletes. And we'll take our best athletes, and we're going to play at our pace. And we're going to go up against those Dukes and North Carolinas and try to get them out of their comfort zone. And we're going to be just as athletic. We're not going to be as skilled and talented, but we're going to be just as athletic as those guys. And so I think that's what could be a huge advantage to him at a St. John's is that style of play and that identity. And I think when he was at Missouri, like those 2 years there, and when they made the Elite Eight, I mean, they were as dangerous a team to play against as anybody and feared. And I don't know, you know, people say you can't win national championships, you know, pressing or whatever.
Playing that way.
Yeah, but I don't know. But I'm sure St. John's would be happy with the string of, you know, four straight tournaments and maybe a Sweet 16 run. And, I mean, they haven't had that kind of success in a while. So I love it. I actually think it's a great hire. And I don't think he has to get these high-profile, you know, guys from New York. Because at the end of the day, those guys are going to go to Duke regardless. And they're going to go to Kentucky regardless. Like, what they need is people that fit exactly the way that he wants to play, which is athletic, long, and tough. And I think he can get that there.
Yeah, I just think New York's a difficult place to navigate if you haven't already built up trust and a relationship. Like, I just don't know how many dudes. Now, again, you don't need a roster full of New York players. You don't. Like, that's not the way I would do it. But I would be trying to get the top three or four. I'd have three or four guys, maybe even as many as six from the New York, New Jersey, that kind of metropolitan area every year on my team. And I just, you know, part of it for me is when I heard, and he hasn't done this yet 100%, but that he would take two guys from his staff from Arkansas when he got the job, Melvin Watkins and
TJ.
TJ
Cleveland.
Those guys with him. And to me, if you put two of those guys on the road and you're not from there too, now again, I haven't heard Melvin Watkins if he's definitely coming on staff or not. So if he goes and gets two other dudes that can recruit New York that have good, strong ties, maybe he has a chance. I don't. I just didn't like it. I didn't like the hire. I mean, again, I just got nothing against Mike Anderson. Although there was, we did have a little issue years ago with Rodney Clark, with a story I wrote years ago when he took over at Arkansas. He didn't let Rodney Clark out of his release right away. Rodney called me, and I said, let me call Mike Anderson, one of his assistants, and give it a couple days, just give it a couple days before I write anything. And gave it a few days, never heard back from Mike Anderson or his assistant. So I wrote it, and it was Rodney Clark requesting his release, I think on the record. And then two signees, one was Hunter Mickelson and Kai Madden, I believe, two of them, both wanting out, according to sources. And Mike Anderson was not overly happy that I wrote that story, but whatever.
Well, and that goes back to your deal. Yeah, it's your job to report, right? And so it's not your job to be a mouthpiece of Mike Anderson or Arkansas. So, yeah, I understand. Well, Jeff, listen, I know I've kept you long enough, man. I really appreciate you taking the time. I don't think Rising Coaches would be where it's at 10 years later with the type of support and help that you've given us over the years. So I really appreciate that. And I'm excited.
When's this year's? What's the date this year?
So July 19th through the 21st in Charlotte will be our 10th anniversary Rising Coaches Conference. So going back to North Carolina, going back to the roots.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, let me know, obviously, how I can help at any point in the future. And hopefully I can make another appearance there if you ever want me. I would love to come back and do it again. I don't know if I could do it July 19th to the 21st in Charlotte. I've just gotten back. It's kind of a tough one in between this year, but we'll hopefully figure something out here maybe next year.
Absolutely. Our doors are always open. We'd love to have you anytime. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Awesome. Thanks, man. I appreciate it, Adam.